From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Between 1850 and 1950, more than 4,000 black men, women, and children were killed in racial terror lynchings in the U.S. No one was convicted of these crimes. At least 40 of these lynchings took place on Maryland soil. We asked Professor Nicholas Crary of Bowie State University, who has researched the Maryland lynchings, who was killed, how, and why. We also meet filmmaker Will Schwartz, president of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project, a nonprofit hosting a conference this weekend with hopes to honor lives lost and reconcile Maryland's dark history.
There can be no reconciliation without first telling the truth. And I think this is an opportunity to tell some very difficult truths and develop a greater empathy.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. In April, the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit based in Montgomery, Alabama, opened the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. It exists to educate and spur dialogue about racial terror lynchings, a heinous practice of our nation's past. It also stands as a memorial to the more than 4,400 black men, women, and children who were lynched in the United States between 1850 and 1950. At least 40 of those lynchings took place on Maryland soil. Here to tell us about his local nonprofit that is hoping to honor those Maryland lives lost is documentary filmmaker Will Schwartz, president of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sheila.
Also with us is Dr. Nicholas Crary, assistant professor of history and government at Bowie State University. Crary has researched the Maryland lynchings in depth and sits on the board of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
Saturday, they'll participate in a conference the nonprofit is hosting along with the Lily Mae Carroll Jackson Civil Rights Museum at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum called Lynching in Maryland, The Journey from Truth to Reconciliation. Well, how did the idea come about to start the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project?
Several years ago, I went to see Bryan Stevenson when he was on his book tour for Just Mercy, which is a life-changing book if you haven't read it.
And Bryan Stevenson is the force behind
he's the force behind the Equal Justice Initiative. And he that happened right before the release of their report on lynching in America. And he discussed it at the talk. And I know that they concentrated on the 12 southern states where most of these lynchings occurred. The original report didn't include a lot of information about Maryland. And so I thought it would someone must be doing that in the state. And as a filmmaker, I was interested in finding out if who was doing that work and possibly doing a story about it. I think it speaks more to my failures as a researcher that I really couldn't find anyone who was doing it. So I ended up working with a friend of mine with his students at Park School. We did an extracurricular thing with these kids for a year and did a lot of research at that time. Through that experience, we discovered not only Dr. Crary's work, but a lot of others. And we arranged conversations with people from the EJI, with someone from the Tuskegee University, who was the archivist there, and a lot of other scholars and lawmakers around the country. And it was a great project. And it just got me really involved in the subject. And I knew at the end of that experience that I didn't want to leave it at that. So I formed the nonprofit. And earlier this year, we incorporated.
What did the Park students discover?
One of the girls who did a senior project about it, one of the things they said that has stuck with me is that racism has a body count. And I think what we all discovered was the scope of the problem, the scope of the issue, how it continues to injure all of us, and the importance of confronting the truth.
Professor Crary, you were working with undergrad students at Bowie State who were researching lynchings, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Tell us about that.
Sure. It actually began as a part of the Summer Undergraduate Research Institute, where faculty are, you know, we're training undergraduate students how to do research from, you know, conceptualizing just, you know, a research question to doing research with primary materials all the way through writing up and presenting their work. And actually, it was the lynching video that they had up at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum that I saw that inspired me to say, let's take a look at, you know, the history of lynching in Maryland. And we found, you know, not much written on the history of lynching in Maryland, but the Maryland State Archives has their Legacies of Slavery website, and that was one of our starting points, you know, because they did have some information and some names. But over the course of our research, we found several people who weren't listed on the State Archives website. We also found names of a couple of people who were listed as unknown. All told, we've come across at least 40 cases in the state of Maryland where, you know, we have documentation that the lynching actually happened. Other things on that front, we found that, you know, the reputation of the Eastern Shore is as the lynching shore, but we found that overwhelming majority of the lynchings that happened in the state of Maryland happened on this side of the bay. The two counties with the most lynchings happening were Prince George's County and Anne Arundel County, with five each. Frederick had three. Montgomery County had three lynchings. So
your total for this state is 44?
Is 40. We only looked at white-on-black terror lynchings. We did not look at the four cases of white-on-white or the one case of black-on-black lynchings that happened.
You mentioned the misconception of this being an Eastern Shore phenomenon when you said it actually occurred more on the Western Shore. Other misconceptions that you found?
Misconceptions, I don't know, but I would certainly say that our research has certainly shown that Maryland was a southern state and very much acts like a southern state, even though we didn't secede from the Union. We were very much southern in the way we approached and policed the African American communities, particularly with regard to interactions, you know, with regard to, you know, assault. I mean, very often that was code for the existence of a clandestine, consensual, interracial sexual relationship. And so that was what usually, and again, in the state of Maryland, of the 40 cases that we found, 27 or 28 of them involved, you know, alleged assaults or attempted rapes of white women by black men.
So you're saying that essentially what had started as some consensual behavior was then described to someone as an assault and resulted in a violent
retribution. Well, that's certainly how it was reported in the local press of the day, the Baltimore Sun and all the local, you know, papers in the various counties. Yeah, I mean, if I can go on, you know, the case of Stanley Moxley out in Washington County was alleged to have attempted to assault a woman in Hancock. And then he wasn't lynched because they brought him to the county jail in Hagerstown. Spends a month behind bars, you know, waiting for his trial. And at his trial, he brought his friends, you know, who said he was in a consensual relationship with this woman. And the judge dropped it from attempted aggravated assault to common assault. He spent 3 months behind bars. And, I mean, I refer to him as the one who survived. I mean, that's, in many cases, what these were about. I mean, because, again, it's the era of Jim Crow. It's that time when white supremacy was the ideology and the order of the day. It meant that, yes, we cannot have, you know, consensual sexual relationships between black and white because that challenges the established order of the day.
Well, Schwartz, it's a big jump from doing research to starting a nonprofit. Is the ultimate goal to create something like the memorial in Montgomery, Alabama?
Well, there are several goals. I think one of the goals is to acknowledge, to research and document these crimes. And to acknowledge them publicly. So there's a community remembrance project component of the at the Equal Justice Initiative that involves soil collection from these lynching sites. It involves erecting historic markers at the sites. And it also involves claiming these memorial columns, duplicate columns that are at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. There's one for every county that they have documented. There are 15 columns there for Maryland, and what we want to do is be able to act as liaison with people in the various counties and facilitate bringing them back to Maryland and having them erected at appropriate spots.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Will Schwartz, president of the Maryland Memorial Lynching Project, also founder of Pennant Productions, and Professor Nicholas Crary of Bowie State University. He's also author of African Intellectuals and Decolonization. We're talking about lynchings in Maryland and the work to reconcile that dark history. Let me pick up with something that the Baltimore Sun, when it profiled the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project last month, quoted you saying, quote, "To understand the problems we're facing with the legal system, the police shootings of African Americans we keep seeing, or the disproportionate incarceration rates among Black Americans, we need to go back 100 years to see how those attitudes developed and in what ways they're still at work." Close quote. Unpack that a little more for us.
To understand what we do today, as a historian, I mean, we have to take it back to the end of the Civil War. When 4 million African-Americans are given their freedom. And there is a genuine fear on the part of former slaveholders, on the part of whites who believe in and buy into the system of white supremacy, that blacks are going to be a threat. And so it's during this period when Jim Crow is being hammered out that all kinds of laws are passed, effectively criminalizing African-American life. It did not take much to get arrested as an African-American. If you were a vagrant, if you didn't have a job, or if you couldn't prove you had a job. And so what this led to was the rise of the convict leasing system, where African-Americans were arrested on a very specious legal charge, tried, you know, convicted, sent to prison, and then the state would lease prisoners out to work for any number of companies, and they would make money on this. And this is basically how the New South was built. And so with this idea of the criminalization of African-American life and African-Americans as criminals, that was the order of the day. That was a huge part of the Jim Crow period. And so, yes, here we are 50-some years past that. We've passed the Civil Rights Act. We've passed the Voting Rights Act. But that idea of black criminality still lingers and still affects the way the legal system interacts with African Americans. I mean, look, for example, at the Department of Justice report that came out in 2016. They only went back to 2010. But there was clear evidence of that racial bias. And that bias begins to develop in that period, 100, 150 years in the making.
Well, one of the Maryland lynching sites is in Towson?
That's correct. In 1885, a young man by the name of Howard Cooper allegedly followed a woman home from the train station that's in, I guess, what would be Rockland now, Brooklynville, something around there, assaulted her in the woods, and she escaped. They eventually found him, caught him, tried him in a trial that lasted. The jury, I think, was out for less than 2 minutes, never left the jury box, never left the courtroom. He was brought back up to Towson, to the jail, and pending an appeal, which was about to happen based on 14th Amendment rights. And the locals decided they didn't want to risk an appeal. And one Sunday evening, assembled at the jail, about 75 people is what the report says. They waited till after midnight because they didn't want to lynch anyone on Sunday, the Lord's Day. And shortly after midnight, they went in and pulled him out and hung him on the spot.
What do we know about Cooper?
Well, one thing we know about Cooper, I think, that's very interesting. At the time, he was described anywhere between 19 and 22 years old, a thug, a known criminal. I think the truth is far different. And actually, someone who, when we did the soil collection in February, someone who attended was interested enough in the case that she went back and did some research in the census records. The lynching took place in 1885. She found him in the 1870 census. And in the 1870 census, he's listed as 6 months old. So that means at the time he was lynched, he was no more than 15 years old. He might have been 14 years old.
Oh, my. You mentioned soil collection. This is part of the reconciliation process. Tell us about it.
Well, as far as, you know, how do we reconcile with that? I mean, that stands as a stark reminder. It's part of that, you know, collecting literally the soil where these men were murdered.
And what happens to the soil?
It's sent down to the...
it's like a jar.
Yeah,
it's
a jar.
It's not a huge amount.
Yeah, sent down to the museum in Montgomery as part of that memorial to remember so that we don't forget who they were and what happened to them and how it happened to them. So that, as they say at Yad Vashem, or as they said at the American Black Holocaust Museum, you know, never again, we must never forget.
So much to think about here. We need to take a quick break here. Will Schwartz is president of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. Dr. Nicholas Crary teaches history and government at Bowie State University. When we're back from the break, we'll look at the conference the nonprofit is hosting Saturday at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum called Lynching in Maryland, The Journey from Truth to Reconciliation, and we'll learn the tragic story of George Armwood. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about lynchings in Maryland and the work being done to reconcile that dark history. The president of the Maryland Memorial Lynching Project, Will Schwartz, is with us. So is Dr. Nicholas Crary, assistant professor of history and government at Bowie State University. On Saturday, you're hosting a conference headlined Lynching in Maryland, The Journey from Truth to Reconciliation. It's also sponsored by the Lily Mae Carroll Jackson Civil Rights Museum and the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, where it will take place. Just a few seats left for the conference. Give us an overview of what's happening.
In Brian Stevenson's talk, he talks about the need for there to be truth before there can be reconciliation. And this is an effort to tell the truth about what happened in Maryland. The conference is broken into three parts. The first is what we know and how we know it. The second is how lynchings continue to affect us now, influence our lives now. And then the third part has to do with how do we respond? What do we do to when confronted with these truths? How do we move forward?
So part of the timing of this conference is it's just around the 85th sad anniversary of the lynching of George Armwood. And you've done a film about that, Will.
Yes. As part of the conference, I've just finished a film about the lynching. Armwood was accused of assaulting an elderly white woman outside of Princess Anne. He was captured, ultimately moved to Baltimore because of the fear of a lynching. And he was brought back to be arraigned and face trial. There was a crowd that's estimated, some people estimate up to 5,000 people who took him from the jail in Princess Anne and lynched him. And you should know that Princess Anne at the time had a population of under 900 people. So this was a huge crowd.
Professor Crary, what kind of people went to lynchings?
Everybody. invariably at the after every lynching, they would hold a jury of inquest to determine what was the cause of death. And inevitably, they all said this person met his death at the hands of parties unknown. The simple reality was everybody knew who was there because it was a community event. It wasn't. This is what makes lynching different from murder. To read the accounts in the newspapers, you know, they knew they were speaking with people who either participated or who were there observing it. I mean, the detail with which these you know, accounts were written, they had to have known.
And yet in Maryland, was anyone ever charged with a crime in relation to a lynching?
No one was ever convicted for lynching an African-American in Maryland.
That's Bowie State University History Professor Dr. Nicholas Crary here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Will Schwartz, president of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project and Pennant Productions. One of the topics that will be covered on Saturday is a panel discussion about how journalism covered the lynchings. Why is that a specific topic?
That's a specific topic because they were part and parcel of the whole lynching process, from the coverage of it, from the perspective on it. You know, again, saying that these were, you know, these were brute Negroes who were attempting to ravish white women. The press is very much culpable in terms of its participation. In terms of maintaining that silence, in terms of, you know, effectively collaborating with the legal system to say, well, we don't know who did this. They would complain that, yes, lynching, you know, violates the law, but effectively these people got what they deserved. And you can see that in just about every, you know, account of the lynchings that are recorded in Maryland. And I should say, yeah, there were 40 in Maryland, but because the Baltimore Sun is one of those, you know, papers of record nationwide, they would get wire reports in of lynchings happening across the country. And, you know, even going with the old Tuskegee numbers of about 3,500 lynchings, that works out to about one or two lynchings a week. So on top of the 40 that you have in Maryland, every week you're getting one, two, maybe three accounts of lynchings happening across the country. So that's contributing to and creating a, you know, this environment of fear, which combined with these notions of black criminality, yes, we have to talk about press complicity in the process of lynching.
So I think it's worth pointing out as well that the accounts in the newspapers varied depending on where the newspaper was published. So the Eastern Shore newspapers treated these crimes far differently than Baltimore papers or national papers. One perfect example is that the Eastern Shore papers praised the fact that the police didn't fire a shot when the jail was being stormed and Armwood was pulled out. On the other hand, papers elsewhere looked at the fact that police didn't fire a shot in disbelief. So you had the same phenomenon interpreted completely different depending on where the newspaper was published.
Why is it important to publicly acknowledge this part of Maryland's past?
Because if we don't acknowledge it, it will be too easy to forget and for something like this to happen again. Teaching history at high school and college levels, there are too many textbooks of U.S. history textbooks that I've seen that give only the most perfunctory coverage to lynching. The new textbooks, you know, that are coming out in Texas that don't talk about slavery but talk about laborers who are being imported, and they talk about the Civil War not having anything to do with slavery but it being about states' rights. Make it all too easy to forget and to erase these moments, these horrible moments of our past from our memories. And just because we don't remember them doesn't mean that they haven't happened. And we have to remember that these happened because
if we're going to have any kind of meaningful reconciliation, we have to recognize that past.
Will Schwartz, what do you hope comes from the conversation on Saturday?
I think it's important. You know, truth and reconciliation are sequential, and there can be no reconciliation without first telling the truth. And I think this is an opportunity to tell some very difficult truths and develop a greater empathy for what happened. I want people to be able to understand these crimes, the influence they continue to have on our lives.
Thank you both for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Documentary filmmaker Will Schwartz, president of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project, and Dr. Nicholas Crary, assistant professor of history and government at Bowie State University. The nonprofit is hosting a conference on Saturday from 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum called Lynching in Maryland, The Journey from Truth to Reconciliation. That museum and the Lily Mae Carroll Jackson Civil Rights Museum are also sponsoring the conference. We've got more information at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!